You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Welcome back to another great episode here on the Swamp Dweller YouTube channel. I really appreciate all of you guys tuning in for another episode. Today we're going to be looking into the creepiest and darkest horror stories from the forest that will freak you out tonight. But first, before we jump into all of that, be sure you subscribe, hit that like button, and throw your comments down below. And before we do that, one last thing, let's jump into our quick sponsor. So recently I discovered Soul, and at first I was like, oh boy, here's another THC CBD product that's supposed to be the next big thing. When they sent me some stuff to try, I was pleasantly surprised. Not only was the raspberry lemonade actually really good flavor-wise, I felt the effects within just a few minutes and was genuinely surprised how well it helped me sleep and alleviated my stress. I used to drink way more than I should, not necessarily because I had a problem, but because I always didn't want to look like I wasn't having a good time with my friends, and I hated all the extra calories, the missed workouts, the hangovers, etc. Soul is a wellness brand that believes feeling good should be fun and easy. Soul specializes in delicious hemp-derived THC and CBD products designed to boost your mood and help you unwind. Their best-selling out-of-office gummies were designed to provide a mild, relaxing buzz, boost your mood, and enhance creativity and relaxation. With 5 different strengths, you can tailor the dose to fit your vibe, from a gentle 1.5 milligram microdose to their newest 15 milligram gummy for a more elevated experience. So what are you waiting for, Swamp Folk? Join many of us today. Bring on the holiday cheer and treat yourself or someone you love to Soul this season. Right now, Soul is offering my audience 30% off your entire order. Go to getsoul.com and use the code SWAMP. That's getsoul.com, promo code SWAMP for 30% off.
I want to take you back to a memory of mine. I was between the ages of 9 and 11 years old at the time. I can't remember exactly how old. I was up visiting my grandparents in Connecticut for the summer, and I was visiting a friend's house at the time. He lived on the edge of some woods, and we were making a fort on the tree line. I remember, very vividly, we both suddenly heard what sounded like a bark or a yelp or something, and we both looked back to see this very tall, almost emaciated type creature. And it was absolutely terrifying. It looked just like the werewolf from Harry Potter, if you've ever seen it. We ran as fast as we could and bolted out of there down the hill. I unfortunately lost my shoe though and had to go back up and get it alone. Luckily, I didn't see that creature again. Welcome back to the swamp, my friends. It's good to see you made it back for another episode. I hope you enjoyed my little memory there. Maybe I'll write it out in more detail sometime. If you have a story that you would like to share in a future video, whether it's a cryptid story, a deep wood story, or something else, be sure to submit your story at swampdweller.net or the email you can find in the description down below. I'd love to share your story with everyone here in the swamp. Now, without further ado, let's get into these creepy and allegedly true deep woods horror stories. I grew up in a densely forested rural area in central Virginia, and like most kids my age, 10 at the time of this story, I spent a lot of time playing in and around the woods. My best friend and I found a creek one day while exploring different deer trails through the woods. This creek we happened upon was a rare find, and the perfect spot for us to play. It was wide and deep enough to swim around in, and had nice, soft mossy banks on either side to rest on after we had tired ourselves out. The water was cool and clear, with no copperheads and no mosquitoes because the water was constantly running. We were psyched. After a few hours of swimming, we had to walk back home for lunch, but made plans to pack lunch the next day so we could have a picnic on the creek banks and spend the whole day there. The next morning, we set out for the woods at around 1 p.m., planning to have the picnic first and swim after. We entered at the same spot we had the previous day and followed what we thought was the same deer trail. It was not. At the point where we should have found the creek, we walked into a small clearing that was covered in a huge thick ferns. We had never walked past this before, so being both hungry and tired of walking, we both decided to eat in the clearing. We laughed and played around there for a little while, spitting watermelon seeds at each other from our lunch. It was an absolute blast, and we were both in wonderful giddy moods. That all changed, however, as soon as we packed up and set out to find the creek. As we walked on, the woods started to feel darker and colder. We got skittish, and I noticed my friend kept whipping her head around to look behind us. After about an hour of walking, we came upon what looked like an entire overgrown bathroom. The sink, toilet, and bathtub, all sitting arranged together and covered in ivy. It is common to find weird stuff like this in the middle of the woods, so we just walked on and made jokes to lighten the mood, calling it Bigfoot's bathroom. After another hour of walking and not seeing anything we recognized, we started to panic. Instead of trying to reach the creek, we were now just trying to find our way back home, or out of the woods at least. I told her we should follow the sun, and eventually we would come up upon a road or someone's property where we could find help. She insisted on trying to find another way, and we began yelling at each other out of fear, and let's be honest, little girl bossiness. I told her if she thought she was so right, she should just go on her way, and we would see who got out first, so we split up. Now, as an adult, I can fully acknowledge I was being a stubborn brat, and a bit of an idiot. The worst possible thing we could have done was split up. Not even 10 minutes after splitting up, I began to hear someone walking maybe 100 feet behind me. Thinking it was my friend, deciding to go my way after all, I slowed down so she could catch up to me. Instead, whatever it was matched my pace. I slow down, it slows down. I stop, it stops. This went on for what felt like hours. The whole time I was going back and forth on whether it was in my head or it was really something following me. I picked up a big stick, swung it a few times to make sure it was sturdy, just to make sure that if I had to hit somebody with it, it would last, and trucked on. As it began to get dark, I came upon something that made my heart sink into my stomach. It was Bigfoot's bathroom. I had just walked in a huge circle for hours, despite being 100% sure I was following the sun west the entire time. Confused and frustrated, I sat down on a log and just screamed my little heart out while smacking my sticks together repeatedly into the ground. As I tried to collect myself, I heard footsteps again, walking up on from behind me. I called out my friend's name as loud as I could but got no answer. Then, after a short pause, the steps began to run towards me. I jumped up and booked it as fast as I could in the opposite direction. Now, this is truly the horrifying part, which I typically omit while telling people this story. As I was sprinting through the darkening woods, I began to hear what I thought were church bells. I looked up to see the darkest, deepest cloud I have ever seen in my life. In the middle of it, it was so black, like it was looking into the night sky, and the dark gray around it seemed to be swirling. It gave me a horrible feeling to look at, almost like nausea. What sickened me further is that I realized the sound of the bells were coming through the hole in the cloud. They were definitely loud. I mean, really booming out of this thing. When I realized this, I stopped dead in my tracks, I felt a sense of absolute and overwhelming dread that has gone unmatched in all my 24 years on this planet. Something in my head began screaming that if I do not run away from whatever the hell that cloud was, no one would ever see me again, and I would be gone. I did not want to run toward the thing, chasing behind me either though, so I made a sharp right and took off away from both. It was now completely dark, and I was running blindly through the trees, smacking through branches, wheezing and tripping every few feet for what seemed like another hour, until I smacked into something low and flew over it, hitting the ground so hard that the air in my lungs was knocked out of me. As I lay there trying to recover, I realized I could not hear the bells anymore. Then my eyes adjusted to the dark, and I realized what had just made me go ass over teeth. It was an old fence. Grabbing hold of it, I prayed that it would lead me to a farm, and sure enough, it did. I walked up over a hill about a mile to get to the farmhouse, explained what had happened, and the farmer graciously gave me a ride back home. I was covered head to toe in scrapes, oozing blood, and was more exhausted than I had ever been in my entire life, but I was finally safe. It was past 9 p.m. when I finally walked through the front door. My friend had gotten back home shortly after we split and figured I had as well, so I hadn't told anybody I was lost, and my family just figured I was still out after dark, which wasn't very uncommon for me. They were shocked when I walked in beat up and crying. No one had been looking for me at all. To this day, I wonder how long they would have waited to come find me if I had not been lucky enough to find the fence, and if it would have been too late. Here is a story that occurred to me about 4 years ago. It was an abnormally cold day. Sure, it can get cold in the late parts of the year, but usually in Louisiana, it doesn't get that cold. Maybe around the high 50s, maybe 60s, but on that day, it was in the low 20s. The carbon dioxide was like a cigarette smoke that came from my mouth as I sighed. I had 2 layers of coats on, very heavy coats, plus a bunch of other stuff to keep me warm. It was a long day at school, and I was ready to get out of there. The school is surrounded by somewhat dense forest. I always look in the tree line as I walk home from school, because I just feel like I'm not alone and I'm being watched. As school ended, I eagerly barked out of the gate and started walking home. My house is a good 30, maybe 40 minutes away. I walked down the same path through the woods as I always did, when suddenly I heard a scream, or more like a screech, that echoed in the forest. It has probably been 20 minutes since I began my walk through the woods, and it's already getting dark. I then begin to smell the stench of something rotten. That is when I almost trip on something. I looked down and almost puked. There, in front of me, were the horrifically mangled remains of a man who had gone missing a few days prior. I froze and moved only my eyes spastically left to right. Nothing. Suddenly, the same screech echoed in the woods, but this time closer than before. I froze again. Then I heard the spine-chilling crunch of leaves and sticks not too far away from where I was. Then, from out of nowhere, the temperature suddenly spiked. It went from freezing to what felt like summer weather, meaning that it gets to almost 110 degrees out of nowhere. By now, I was scared out of my mind. I started fast walking when something felt like it was watching me. I swerved around, and with the dying light, I saw it. It was fast. So fast that I only caught the sheer size of whatever it was. It was at least 8 feet tall. I screamed unintentionally and ran. Then, I tripped on the roots of a tree that were probably 3/4 of the way through the forest, which ended up absolutely murdering my right leg. Then, I saw those eyes. It was pitch black and the temperature was so dang hot. But, I know what I was looking at. It was a set of eyes, at least 15 feet away just staring at me. They were glowing yellow with jet black viper pupils. I slowly reached in my back pocket, not leaving the vision of those eyes. My fingers met my phone, and I pulled it out gingerly. I turned the flashlight on, and I still have nightmares about it to this day. In the few seconds I had, I screamed the absolute crap out of my lungs at that sight. The beast was dark crimson in color, almost like blood. Its sternum protruded from its chest with a point. It had long, black hair with two curved crimson horns. It had two pairs of blood-red wings. The upper ones were massive, while the lower ones were shorter and thinner. A long crimson tail flicked in the air as well. Instead of fingers, it had what I can describe more like clawed talons. But what the most horrifying thing about this creature was its unholy grin. That darn grin was stretching to its ears, and its teeth were huge. These teeth, if I had to guess, were at least a foot long or so. They were like kitchen knives. Before I could even take a picture, it ran off with such speed that it pulled air away. I started limping away, not noticing that the bone in my leg was literally protruding through my skin. Then I fell, looked up, and there it was. It grabbed me and hoisted me in the air. It had me face to face. It snorted in my face. It reeked of decay. It was the most disgusting thing I think I've ever smelled in my life. I was 13 at the time, and I was a major wuss, some would say. I cried. I sobbed, and my face went to tears. It is at that point the creature, maybe feeling sympathetic, cocked its head and put a finger to my mouth. It was burning hot and felt like stone. Then, everything went black. When I came to, I was at my front door, confused. I looked around and saw very clearly the same glowing eyes at me from bushes in the garden. But as soon as I saw them, they vanished. I then looked down at my leg to see that it was back to normal. But I turned my leg over to see something, or someone, carved a huge symbol into my knee. I don't know what it was I saw, but I started writing short stories about it ever since. I know the whole clown thing had its time, but I have a story that I thought would be worth telling you. A few years back in a small town in Michigan, back when the whole killer clown epidemic was going around, I used to think of it as pretty stupid and thought that no one would actually, you know, have any real encounters. I thought maybe nobody died and nobody was actually being stalked. But this story that I'm about to tell you takes place back in the summer and fall of 2017, maybe around the start of August. The summer heat just started to cool down, but the clown story started to rise to what a lot of people were talking about. I never really thought much about it, because the only thing I really ever got scared of was not knowing what is next in life. Occasionally, I would hear rustling in the woods located behind my house when I was either taking out the trash or coming home from sports practice. But one day, I looked out my window and saw a brightly colored man or woman in a clown costume. And at this time, I was home alone and I could in fact not have any chance of standing up for myself if this clown would have come to my house and tried to get in. At this time, I had no phone, and the only way I had to pretty much get in contact with people were to run to the neighbor's house. I was forced to go out of my room because I had to use the bathroom really badly, but when I came back to watch my spot, the clown was gone. Fast forward about 2 to 3 months, I was home alone once more and looked out of my living room window and saw a man peering into my house. So I looked up in shock, and right as he did, me and the man made eye contact. He then smiled with the worst smile I have ever seen in my life. He then flashed the most yellow teeth that I've ever seen, right when I was going to do something, and I passed out from fear. Well, that's what my parents told me, because they got home and picked me up off the ground. To this day, I can still see that clown's yellow teeth, and every time I just want to throw up. I don't go near those woods because of how many weird things I've seen. But these clowns that seemingly like to roam around them are the creepiest I've seen yet. Thank you for sharing my story. I know it's a bit late on the killer clown trend, but I do hope you enjoyed my story, even though it might be a little uneventful. This story takes place in the boonies of Allenson, Michigan, about 2 years ago. I was over at my best friend Marcus's house. His house, for reference, is like a large barn-like structure with a basement. It was about the second week into the summer, and we were up for a snack run, like we normally do when it gets late, and we don't like to wake his grandparents. I don't get scared very easy, and I've always had unnaturally great hearing. So, I could tell when someone was moving around even in the dark with my eyes closed, and know where they were, and a rough idea of how tall they were, and how far they would be. I was pretty great for hide-and-seek. My friend Marcus and our other friends soon began to realize that I was pretty hard to play against. It was around 2 or 3 a.m. We were wide awake and bored. We decided to start a small campfire in the backyard, next to their camper, about 300 yards away from the house and surrounding Marcus's grandparents' house, is nothing but woods. We sit down and talk for a while, and then our friend Jay wanted to go into the camper for a while because he gets cold easy, and there are blankets in there. We decided that we would go in with him because he didn't want to be left alone. I was watching the fire because it always calms me down. I decided to stay out by the fire for a little longer. I started to realize that there were no crickets or bullfrogs making any noise, so I glanced around with my back to the camper, and I didn't see anything. At least, not at first. So, I didn't think anything of it. I start hearing more footsteps, though, coming from the edge of the woods. I looked up to see this dog-like creature on the edge of the woods, just behind the tree line. Its head was easily 5 to 6 feet from the ground, with yellowish-green eyes that seemed to glow. I didn't think anything of it, because animals are curious, just like we humans are. But I kept an eye on it. But not 3 minutes later, Marcus comes out of the camper and locked eyes with something to the left. There were two shadowy-like figures walking back and forth in the field, getting closer and closer. He sits down beside me while watching the figures and asked me if I saw them too. I told him I did and described exactly what I was seeing. I told him it felt like they were about 200 feet away, and low to the ground. I pointed out the creature I was staring down in the tree line as well, and told him to keep an eye out if they got closer, and if they did, go inside the camper, and not to come out unless I said otherwise. But thankfully, it didn't come to that. Morning broke and we were all pretty tired, but then I checked later in the day where the creature stood to see if there were any footprints or anything. I did notice that the grass was matted down, but I didn't notice any distinct footmarks. I didn't tell Marcus or Jay that, because I wanted to keep them out of that stuff, because once you've had an encounter with one, you're bound to have another one or so. Thank you for sharing my story. I'd appreciate it a lot, if I could get any sort of ideas of what it may be. I've been watching your channel for a few years now, and I love the encounters everyone has shared. I think what I saw that night might be a dogman, but I'm not sure.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook, you know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
For a little backstory, Daniel was my childhood best friend from my neighborhood, and he lived in the building next to mine in the year of 1993, if I remember correctly. But we all called him Dan for short. This is his story, and he swears it's totally true. Since Dan was 8 or 9 years old, his mother, his stepfather, and he moved to a small neighborhood in a city in South America, which is located in a valley and is surrounded by a mountain and woods on all sides. The neighborhood was on the east side of the city on a dead-end street of a closed neighborhood, but there were a lot of green areas all around it, such as small hills with big and small trees, plants, flowers, grass, 2 parks, and a sports court. When Dan and his family moved to the neighborhood, he was very happy because when they were getting there in his mom's car, he could see lots of places where he could play in and explore. So as a kid, that was a very exciting thing. Even though the hills, woods, and plants that surrounded Dan's new neighborhood looked really nice during the day, and while the sun was up, they looked very dark and creepy at night, and he thought they were really scary. He felt an ominous presence from those woods at night. At that age, Dan was afraid of many things, like the dark, the woods, wolves, black dogs, cats, spiders, sharks, you name it. Just like me, and this was because he was a total mama's boy. And at 5 years old, what do you expect? When Dan and I met for the first time, we were both playing in the park while our babysitters were watching us and talking to each other. We immediately bonded and became friends because we had a lot of things in common. We started talking about our favorite TV shows and movies such as Star Wars, Dragon Ball Z, the X-Men cartoons, and Ninja Turtles, among many others. So, we used to play by pretending we were superheroes or some sort of cartoon character while running around, using the merry-go-round, the slides, the swings, and funny enough, we both had plastic lightsabers. So we fought as if we were Jedis or Ninja Turtles, but we never stayed in the park once the sun went down either, because our sisters did not let us, or we were just too scared, honestly. However, Dan was not my only friend in the neighborhood. I introduced him to my other friends who lived in my building and other buildings and houses. Their names were the following: Eliza, Diego, JP, Mike, Laura, and Gerard. All of us were around the same age, and we all became great friends as the months went by, because almost every afternoon we played sports, played in the park, trick-or-treated, had water balloon fights, played Nintendo together, climbed the hills and woods behind our buildings during the day, and even did everything together. The neighborhood kids liked to joke around by saying that the woods behind the buildings were haunted. At that time, we played hide-and-seek or cops and robbers, so we ran around the street until 7 p.m. because that was our curfew, and we had to do our boring homework after that. But Dan and I went to bed late at night in secret while we talked quietly on the phone. That night, it was like 9 or 10 p.m., I think. Dan asked me the following: "Did you watch X-Men today?" "Yeah, dude, of course. I would not miss it for the world. Did you see the fight against Apocalypse and the Four Horsemen?" "Yeah, dude. That fight was awesome. I loved it. But talking about something else, have you heard some creepy noises behind your building at night?" "Nah, bro, I'm a deep sleeper, so I usually black out." "Wow, I wish I was that lucky. Yeah, I usually can hear footsteps in those woods at night, and I also sleepwalk sometimes. Well, I think it's time for me to go to sleep. See you tomorrow. Take care, bro." "Sure thing, man. Talk to you tomorrow. Take care." Dan hung up his favorite hamburger-shaped phone, sat down in bed, grabbed an old fantasy book about dragons that was on his nightstand, and started reading it until he began to close his eyes and doze off. He fell into a deep sleep, and was now dreaming, or so he thought. In his dream, Dan could hear the crickets in the forest, but was woken up by some strange steps walking around the forest and the leaves crunching beneath him, or as if some person or animal was walking in the woods. There are a lot of cats in the neighborhood, so he thought it was one of those cats potentially, maybe a possum or an owl. All of a sudden, he heard a low whisper that beckoned him and said, "Daniel, it's Professor X. The X-Men need your help. Come to the woods and help us. This strange, but yet familiar voice was very similar to the professor's voice from his favorite cartoon, and it sounded like it was right outside of his window. Since he was a naive and innocent child, he decided to get out of bed, put on his jacket and boots, took his glasses, got out of his apartment, and went to the ground floor. Once he was on the ground floor, he walked to his building's parking lot. He felt a little cold, so he rubbed his shoulders with his hands. The voice kept calling out to him, "Help the X-Men, Dan!" Somehow, he felt extremely attracted to this voice, like metal to a magnet, because he could not get it out of his head. He took a small leap to get on top of a small hill. He then felt very scared, but kept walking into the dark and creepy woods. While he was walking, he heard other footsteps and leaves crunching beside his. He felt like these steps were approaching his position. At that moment, he stopped walking so he could hear the steps more clearly, since he thought it was some crazy person or an animal that was insane enough to walk in the woods in the middle of the night. There are a lot of cats in this neighborhood, like I said, so Dan thought it was one of those cats. Maybe it was some other sort of animal, but then he heard a noise that sounded like a roar. He thought it sounded very similar to those dinosaurs from Jurassic Park. He had recently seen that movie in theaters, so it was the closest thing he could think of. Suddenly, he heard fast steps from somebody or something running in his direction. Dan broke out of his trance. He looked around, and his little kid's mind felt so terrified that he passed out, and fortunately, when he hit the ground, his body was positioned between a tall tree and a large boulder. So, he barely heard how this trickster creature ran next to him, circled his location, and then it smelled the air in order to get a scent, but he guessed it decided to leave. Dan assumed he had passed out for several hours because he was woken up by the sound of a woodpecker, cicadas, and birds that were on a nearby tree. The heat and glare from the sun in his face woke him up. He rubbed his eyes, opened them, and looked all around him. He was in shock and horrified when he looked at his Spider-Man watch and saw that it was 6 a.m. He had woken up in the middle of the forest. He thought he was going to wake up in his bed because he was dreaming, but he had sleepwalked into the forest in order to follow that beckoning voice. He saw his clothes were full of fallen leaves, so Dan quickly stood up, brushed the leaves from his arms and legs, and ran away from that creepy forest, which looked normal during the day. He climbed down the forest until he got into his parking lot. He ran to his building's door, opened it, ran to the elevator, and he saw himself in the mirror and could not believe that happened to him. Dan got to his apartment door, opened the door silently, tiptoed inside the apartment's hallway, and saw that thankfully his mother and father had not woken up yet. So, he went to bed and stared at the ceiling, trying to process what occurred last night. He completely believed his parents when they told him not to listen to strangers, especially if they are in the middle of a dark and creepy forest. So, Dan had many questions and thought to himself, how did this creature imitate Professor X's voice? How did it know he would listen to it? How did it know he loved the X-Men cartoon? Maybe he would never find out, or maybe he would. Who knows?
My terrifying experience with what I think is a skinwalker. By Connor P. This story goes way back. I believe it was either 2009 or 2010. It's hard to believe that this was over a decade ago now. Anyway, my girlfriend Lakayla and I took a road trip to visit her mom and some of her family living there on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona. We also brought along our friend Shannon, who was also of Navajo descent. We arrived there at night and, as you probably know, there isn't much electricity or anything like that on a reservation. Even running water is scarce. So it gets very dark out there at night. I found it absolutely remarkable how the stars lit up in the dark sky. You could see everything. There was no light pollution. It was like being in a planetarium. Even now, I can remember how picturesque it was. I suppose nature had to give us something beautiful before it unleashed one of its abnormalities upon us. Shannon wanted to visit her friend named Luis, and we tagged along. We soon arrived at Luis's hogan and went inside. Inside, the floor was earthen,
lit only by the dim glow of kerosene lamps. It truly was a different way of life out here. Up to that point, I had never been inside a traditional Navajo hogan, and this was all new and interesting to me. After some time, Lakayla inquired about using the restroom. "You're welcome to use the outhouse around back, but be careful. There have been some sightings of mountain lions recently." Luis handed me a .357 revolver with some rounds to load it with. "You should accompany her, just to be safe." I was enthralled, and I was no stranger to pistols or anything. I loaded the cylinder, closed it up, and before we loaded out, I was ready to go. The starlight illuminated a gravel path leading to the outhouse. I was on high alert the entire time, fully expecting a mountain lion to come ripping around the corner any moment. So I was paying extra attention to my surroundings. I couldn't help but notice that things were quiet. Too quiet, if you ask me. This is typically indicative of, you know, a large predator being around. I gripped the revolver tightly in my hand. Suddenly, I saw something moving through the brush. But it was so dark I couldn't tell if it was just my eyes playing tricks on me. The last thing I wanted to do was blow away someone's dog on a Native American reservation. Another thing I noticed was a distinct odor in the air. It smelled like someone had emptied out a year's worth of bedpans and let it saturate in the hot sun. All in all, it smelled freaking terrible. It's a good thing that I have a strong stomach, or that stench would have put any average man on his butt. Lakayla didn't seem to mind it at all, though she finished up inside and we started heading back. Something darted out of the brush as we were doing so. I raised the revolver, but I didn't shoot it first. I didn't get a good look at it. Still, it ran off quickly. As I stated before, I was a bit apprehensive about carrying a firearm on Navajo land. I didn't want to shoot anything or anyone by accident other than an attacking mountain lion. We returned to the hogan, and I unloaded the revolver and returned it to Louise. Louise had her kids there, and it was a rather small living space. She made us feel welcomed, but I got the sense that she didn't want us to stay there. No sweat, we still had to get to Shannon's mom's house anyway. I should mention that Shannon's mom is Hopi and lives in a separate area of the reservation. To make a long story short, there is no law of loss between the Hopi and Navajo tribes. Getting around the reservation can be problematic if you're unfamiliar with the area, and directions from locals could be convoluted.
"Well, you take a right here, then there's an old red tire over there, and then you take down that fork, you know, that you'll see it in the road, and then you make a left."
So pretty much it's kind of hard to understand what the heck's actually going on. Unfortunately, the Navajo Nation is 27,000 square miles of dirt roads and dry wash arroyos. It's easy to get lost out there, as there's enough shrubbery to make it impossible to see in any real direction. But even she had struggled to locate the Hopi territory. The road was narrowly lined with pinyon trees and juniper bushes. As we made our way down the road, as I was driving, I kept seeing something move through the brush, keeping pace with us. Suddenly, something came out of the forest and struck the car. Holy crap, what the heck was that? I immediately hit the brakes, thinking that I might have hit someone. Shannon then leaned forward and grabbed my shoulder.
"Do not get out of the car, we need to keep going."
I turned back to look at her.
"You don't think I should go check?"
My voice stopped. My lip began to involuntarily quiver when I saw something through my back window. It looked like a very tall person, crouching at a somewhat awkward angle. In the faint glow of the taillights, I could see what looked like an animal hide. Then a pair of two glowing eyes came into view.
"Oh, hell no,"
I said, and slammed down on the gas pedal and peeled out of there. When I looked into the rear view mirror, my worst fears came true. There was a massive creature chasing after the car, gaining on us. I knew I was not going crazy when I saw something earlier. The thing then leaped up into the air and disappeared from view, but I instantly knew where it was going to end up. I slammed on the brakes before the creature landed directly in front of us. As it stood to its feet, all three of us got a good look at its form. It appeared to be a cross between a mountain lion and some sort of human. Its bottom half resembled a pair of human legs, surmounted by a muscular torso that wore black and red markings. Its chest and torso were quite muscular. Its animalistic face leered at us with a pair of ethereal white eyes, baring a row of sharp canines at us. It was almost grinning at us, if that makes sense.
"We have to get out of here,"
Shannon screamed as I threw the car into reverse. almost swerving off the road before quickly maneuvering the vehicle to face the opposite direction. A little trick I learned during my park ranger training. It's good to know if you need to back out of somewhere quickly, you can. As we flew back down the road, I kept looking in the rearview mirror to see if that thing was still following us, but there was nothing, which was almost as unnerving. We finally got back to the highway that led to Tuba City. I think we lost it, I said as I took a left onto the road. But to my absolute horror, I saw something running through the forest alongside us. Now that we were back on a paved road, albeit one that was full of potholes and rocks, I was able to pick up enough speed to outrun the creature. However, it left us with a parting gift. Just before we left it in the dust, it emerged from the forest once more and struck the car again, almost causing us to spin out into a ditch. But as I was able to stabilize the car, I am certain the same chill felt crawl down each of our spines when it let out a loud, angry wail that could be heard over the car's engine with the windows rolled up. I've been through some real scary times in my life, but nothing has ever put the fear of God in me like that sound did. We finally made it out to Tuba City, and I don't think I slowed down one time that entire trip. We stopped at a gas station before driving the long way to Hopi territory. When we arrived at Shannon's mother's house, Shannon told her what had happened, speaking in hushed tones. Lakayla and I weren't sure what to do or say. We'd come face to face with an ancient creature known as a skimwalker. Not too many folks lived to tell the tale about it. Shannon's mom burnt some sage and prayed for us, but I don't think we slept a wink that night.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Now, before I jump right into this next story, it's a long one. I had to connect several theories, several crimes, and several murders over several different years to be able to put this together for you. It does end up in the Redwood State Park, and I promise you it will end up in the woods at some point. But there's a few things we have to cover in the beginning so you understand why this is such a big deal and how many serial killers actually roam the woods of our great country. It could be argued that a reign of terror began in California in the late 1960s. In the South, the summer of 1969 saw the Manson family murders in Los Angeles. This included the infamous home invasion, in which actress Sharon Tate and four others were killed at knife or gunpoint. Tate was 8.5 months pregnant when she died. Northern California was rocked by the homicides and serial killings around the same time. This is the subject of today's video. The mysterious Zodiac Killer murdered 5 people and wounded 2 others in and around San Francisco. David Faraday and Betty Jensen were fatally shot in December 1968. They were a young couple, both under the age of 18 years old. The killer shot another couple in July of 1969. 19-year-old Michael Magoe and 20-year-old Darlene Farren. Magoe survived, but Farren sadly died from her injuries. 20-year-old Brian Hartnell and 22-year-old Cecilia Shepherd were stabbed in September of the same year. Hartnell survived, but Shepard passed away 2 days after the attack. The killer's next victim was Paul Stein, a 29-year-old taxi driver. He was shot nearly 2 weeks after the assault on Hartnell and Shepard. The Zodiac Killer is suspected of other murders. He would contact the media to take credit for over 37 murders, but investigators don't agree on whether he was actually the perpetrator. The Zodiac Killer was never caught, and his identity remains unknown to this day. He is believed to be a white male based on multiple witness statements. San Francisco is about 70 miles north of Santa Cruz. The Zodiac murders were probably too close for comfort for many Santa Cruzans. Others might have been relieved to have a distance between them and this vicious killer. Little did they know, though, Santa Cruz was about to fall victim to a killing spree of its own. The extent of it would be dubbed the murder capital of the world. The Ota Residence, October 19th, 1970. On October 19th, 1970, firefighters responded to reports of a blaze in the coastal town of Sokol. The burning building has a custom-built Japanese-inspired mansion, home to eye surgeon Dr. Victor Ota and his family. Two cars belonging to Ota and his secretary blocked access to the property. These were parked there by the killer. Once on the scene, emergency responders set out to tackle the blaze. One firefighter was searching for a fire hydrant to attach another hose when his flashlight caught something floating in the swimming pool. He took a closer look and then discovered 5 bodies in the water. The victims were identified as Dr. Victor Ota, his wife Virginia, their 2 sons, 12-year-old Derek and 11-year-old Taggart, and Victor's secretary, Dorothy Cadwallader. They were bound with silk scarves and shot to death, execution style. A note was found tucked beneath the windshield wiper of the family's Rolls Royce. The killer typed it out using Dr. Ota's very own typewriter. The note claimed that the people of the free universe would kill anyone who misuses or destroys the natural environment. The police appealed to the public for any information. They received numerous responses about a man in his mid-20s named John Lindley Frazier. He lived in a small shack about a half of a mile away from the Ota residence. He was known for telling anyone who would listen that he had been selected by God to save the environment, and rich men like Victor Ota were destroying the world. Frazier was arrested in his shack 4 days after the Ota murders. He was deemed legally sane and stood trial for 5 counts of murder. On his first day in court, he turned up with shaggy hair and a long beard on one side of his face, and a head free of hair and nothing else, even the eyebrow was missing, on the other side. He later fully shaved his head following advice from his attorney. On November 21st, 1971, he was found guilty and sentenced to death. This would be changed to life imprisonment in 1972 after the death penalty was abolished in California. Frazier took his own life in Mule Creek State Prison in 2009. The Ota's 2 teenage daughters were away at boarding school, luckily. The eldest, sadly, ended her own life 7 years later, though. In the days between the Ota murders and Frazier's arrest, several locals admitted to feeling afraid and sleeping with loaded guns. Unfortunately, though, this was just the beginning. Marianne Pesk and Anita Lucheza, May 7th, 1972. On May 7th, 1972, 18-year-old Fresno State University students Marianne Pesk and Anita Lucheza went missing. They planned to hitchhike to Stanford to visit friends and were reported missing when they never turned up. Marianne's skull was discovered 3 months later on the Loma Prieta Mountain. A subsequent search failed to locate further remains or any sign of Anita. Aiko Ku, September 14, 1972. And just a month later, in September, 15-year-old Aiko Ku went missing on her way to a dance class. Her mother had advised her to take the bus because she was concerned about her daughter's hitchhiking habit. Mrs. Ku suspected Aiko must have hitchhiked after missing the bus, but the police said it was more likely that Aiko had run away. Mrs. Ku printed and distributed flyers, but nobody came forward with any information. She was convinced foul play was involved, It's likely some investigators agreed to an extent considering the death of Marianne, but the police seemed intent on pursuing the teen runaway theory. Lawrence Whitey White, October 13, 1972. On October 13th, 55-year-old Lawrence Whitey White was beaten to death with a baseball bat. His body was discovered the next day in the woods near Highway 9. Now, this is very brief, but it might play into the actual serial killer theory a little bit later. Mary Guilfoyle, October 24th, 1972. On October 24th, 24-year-old student Mary Guilfoyle went missing after attempting to hitchhike near Cabrillo College. Her skeletonized body was discovered in the Santa Cruz Mountains almost 4 months later, relatively close to where Marianne Pesk's skull was found. Father Henry Tomei, November 2, 1972. On November 2nd, 64-year-old Catholic priest Father Henry Tomei was stabbed and stomped to death at St. Mary's Church in Los Gatos. His body was found in the confessional booth. A witness saw the attacker fleeing the church but having only glimpsed enough to describe him as a tall, thin man. This, of course, didn't give investigators much to go on. The police initially suspected it was a robbery gone wrong. Cindy Schall, January 7th, 1973. The murders continued into the new year. On January 7th, 1973, 18-year-old Cabrillo College student Cynthia Cindy Schall went missing. Over the following 2 weeks, various people stumbled across dismembered body parts. Only the right hand and head were never recovered. Fingerprints from the left hand confirmed Schall's identity. X-rays of the severed torso also matched Schall's X-rays from the previous year. Cabrillo College and UCSC, the University of California, Santa Cruz, students were warned against hitchhiking because it seemed female hitchhikers were being targeted. UCSC students were advised to travel in pairs, always tell someone where they were going, and catch the bus even when it's inconvenient. Students were also told to wave at campus patrol cars if they needed a ride. Staff would be willing to give them a lift because of the recent murders. Jim and Joan Gianera. On the 25th of January, 25-year-old Jim Gianera and his 21-year-old wife Joan were shot dead in their home on Western Drive. Jim had a history of disturbing narcotics, so investigators assumed the murders were connected to drugs and failed to link this crime to the previous murders. Fortunately, the Gianera's child was with Joan's mother that night and survived. Kathy Francis, David Hughes, Damon Francis. January 25th, 1973. That very same day, 29-year-old Kathy Hughes and her two sons, 9-year-old David Hughes and 4-year-old Damon Francis, were fatally shot in their home on Mystery Shot Road. Kathy's husband, who was away at the time of the shooting, also dealt drugs. Plus, their house was previously occupied by Jim Gianera. So these murders were again assumed to be related to narcotics of some kind. Rosalind Thorpe and Allison Louis. On February 5th, two UCSC students, 23-year-old Rosalind Thorpe and 20-year-old Allison Louis, disappeared. Both women were reported missing the next day. Their friends feared the worst and searched the woods but found no sign of them. And now we finally come upon where you all have been waiting for. The Henry Cowell Redwood State Park murders. February 10th, 1973. On February 10th, four teenage friends were camping at Henry Cowell Redwood State Park. The park is situated between the cities of Santa Cruz and Scotts Valley near the town of Felton. The main section of the park contains over 15 miles of hiking trails, which some have led to lonely beaches along the San Lorenzo River. Other paths boast breathtaking views of the Santa Cruz Mountains. It's ordinarily a beautiful place to enjoy nature, but in February 1973, 9-year-old Brian Scott Card, 18-year-olds David Oliker and Robert Spector, and 15-year-old Mark Drybelbis were fatally shot with a .22 caliber pistol. After the media descended, District Attorney Peter Chang was heard muttering, "This must be Murdersville, USA." Several news outlets reported him referring to Santa Cruz as the murder capital of the world. Chang claimed he was misquoted, but considering the disturbing amount of high numbers of recent murders, in which victims were often seemingly targeted at random, many Santa Cruzans were understandably frightened. The last few years had indeed felt like living in the murder capital of the world. As a side note, Henry Cow Redwood State Park became a serial killer's hunting ground once again in 1981 when David Carpenter shot a couple who were hiking. The male victim survived, but the female was fatally wounded. Fred Perez, February 13, 1973, 3 days after the campers were killed in the park, 72-year-old Fred Perez was weeding in front of his yard, outside of his home in Lighthouse Avenue, when a car passed, circled back, and then pulled over nearby. The driver got out, seemingly at random, and fatally shot Perez with a rifle in broad daylight. Neighbors and witnesses recorded the shooter's license plate. This led to a suspect being stopped and arrested shortly after the shooting. The man's name was Herbert Mullen. Herbert Mullen was born April 18, 1947. He was popular at school growing up. At home, his father was reportedly strict but not abusive. When Mullen was 16, he was voted most likely to succeed by his classmates. However, he also began to struggle around this time. One of his close friends died in a car accident. Mullen made shrines to his friend and began to obsess over various things, including reincarnation. He also started hearing voices. By his mid-20s, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and had been repeatedly admitted to mental health facilities. When he wasn't in a hospital, his use of LSD and marijuana might have amplified his symptoms. With Mullen in custody, the police were able to question him and learn more about his crimes and motivations. Mullen's birthday fell on the anniversary of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. He believed this meant he was responsible for preventing further quakes, and the human bloodshed that he would subsequently go after would prevent these natural disasters. He said the Vietnam War averted earthquakes on American soil, but with the war ending for Americans, more deaths would be required to prevent another quake. He heard voices reinforcing this message. Often, this was the voice of his father. Mullen pretended he had car trouble when he came across Lawrence White on the highway. White offered to help him in exchange for a ride. Mullen said White sent telepathic messages offering himself as a sacrifice so the others could be saved. Mullen claimed his father telepathically instructed him to kill Mary Guilfoyle. He picked her up when she was hitchhiking and then stabbed her through the chest while driving. He then sliced open her body looking for pollution, removing her organs and hanging them on tree branches for examination. Having doubts about his actions, he visited Father Henry Tomei to confess. As with Lawrence White, Mullen allegedly believed the priest offered himself as a sacrifice. Tomei was stabbed and beaten to death in his confessional booth. In early 1973, Mullen blamed his former drug use for his problems. He went to confront Jim Gianera, one of his high school classmates who had given him drugs back in the day. Mullen went to Gianera's former residence, where a woman named Kathy Francis answered the door. She told him the Gianeras lived down the road now. At the correct house, Mullen shot Jim Gianera, who crawled to tell his wife Joan to lock herself in the bathroom. But Mullen kicked down the door before shooting her too. Both Gianeras died from their injuries. Thankfully, their child was at Joan's mother's house that night. Mullen returned to the Francis household where he shot Kathy and her two sons, allegedly believing Kathy telepathically offered herself and her children as sacrifices. Although there are some disputes over whether he murdered Kathy and her sons before leaving to kill the Gianeras. The following month, Mullen was hiking in Henry Cowell Redwood State Park when he came across four friends who were camping illegally. He pretended to be a park ranger and told them to leave because they were polluting the forest. He later returned and shot them with a .22 caliber pistol because they were still there.
He took their .22 caliber rifle, which he used to kill Fred Perez in broad daylight a few days later, leading to his arrest. But some press outlets reported that Mullen was not only known to Jim Gianera, but also to Fred Perez and Kathy Francis's widower. It is unclear how well acquainted they actually were. In August 1973, Mullen was sentenced to life imprisonment. He was denied parole 8 times and remained incarcerated until his death in August of 2022. He died of natural causes at the age of 75. In the immediate aftermath of Mullen's arrest, many Santa Cruzans breathed a sigh of relief, thinking the killer was caught and the worst was over. Mullen's victims differed in age, gender, race, and religion. His methods and weapons also varied. Most of the victims were shot, but some were stabbed and/or beaten. This is why investigators struggled to connect his crimes prior to his arrest. If Mullen hadn't confessed, it's possible we wouldn't have linked him to many of these murders. Mary Guilfoyle was the only female hitchhiker Mullen confessed to killing. Some people thought, or perhaps hoped, Mullen was also responsible for abducting the other hitchhikers. But a few days after Mullen's arrest, road workers stumbled upon human remains just off Eden Canyon Road in Castro Valley. At first, the workers thought they were looking at discarded mannequins, but they soon realized they had found 2 headless and dismembered corpses. The bodies were later identified as Allison Louis and Rosalind Thorpe. Panic erupted, with people asking how bodies were still turning up if Mullen was off the streets. District Attorney Peter Chang replied, "We then have another homicidal maniac." Thorpe and Louis went missing before Mullen's arrest, so his involvement wasn't impossible. But both women had been sexually violated, as had Cindy Shawl. This, along with the dismembering, wasn't consistent with Mullen's usual M.O. There wasn't much doubt at this point that 2 serial killers had been stalking Santa Cruz at the same time, and only one of them was in custody currently. Chang did try to imply out-of-town killers could be using Santa Cruz as a dumping ground, but this didn't really make sense because the victims were all local college students. When an acquaintance calls. In late April 1973, the Santa Cruz Police Department received a call made from a phone back in Pueblo, Colorado. The caller confessed to killing his mother and her best friend. Recognizing the voice as belonging to a local man named Big Ed, the police laughed and told him to stop messing with them. Big Ed, full name Edmund Kemper, called again a few hours later, and this time, the call led to his arrest. He confessed to murdering a further 6 women: Mary Ann Pask, Anita Lucheza, Aiko Ku, Cindy Shawl, Rosalind Thorpe, and Allison Louis. Edmund Kemper was born December 18, 1948. He was known to torture insects as a child, and he killed 2 family cats before dismembering one and decapitating the other. His mother, Clarnell, struggled with alcohol addiction. She often abused and belittled Edmund, her only son. This included mocking him for his height. He was 6'4", telling him no one would ever love him, and locking him in the basement because she feared he would hurt and molest his sisters. The abuse worsened after his parents split in 1957, and his father, who he was close to, moved out. Edmund was later sent to live with his paternal grandparents. He didn't enjoy this time with them. He said his grandfather was senile and his grandmother emasculated both him and his grandfather. At the age of 15, he shot his grandmother with a rifle following an argument. His grandparents had previously confiscated the rifle after Edmund used it to needlessly shoot animals. His grandmother's last words were reportedly, "You'd better not be shooting the birds again." When his grandfather returned home from a grocery run, Edmund fatally shot him in the driveway. He later said, "I just wondered how it would feel to shoot Grandma," and claimed he killed his grandfather so he wouldn't have to learn about his dead wife. Kemper was arrested and later diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. He was sent to Astacardero State Hospital for the criminally insane. He was released on parole into the care of his mother, and on his 21st birthday, he was a free man. Clarnell had married and divorced while Edmund was in hospital,
so she now had the last name Strandberg. She worked as an administrative assistant at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Edmund's juvenile record was expunged after psychiatrists deemed him rehabilitated. He aspired to work in law enforcement, but he was rejected because, being 6'9", he was considered too tall to be a police officer. Despite this, he was well-liked by local police officers. He frequented bars where they hung out. One officer gave him a police academy trainee's badge. During this time, his home life remained turbulent. His neighbors often heard him embroiled in loud arguments with his mother. He moved out after saving some money, but would often return to his mother's home due to financial difficulties. He took to driving around university areas, frequented by young female hitchhikers. He claimed he picked up upwards of 150 women and drove them to their destination. These weren't quite the uneventful rides most of his passengers thought they would have, though, because Kemper hid weapons in the car and attempted to lock passengers in without them noticing. A woman seemed reluctant to travel with a giant lone man. He would look at his watch, feigning impatience. This usually worked because it pressured the women to make a quick decision and gave the impression he didn't care one way or another about giving them a ride. He picked up Marianne and Anita, offering to take them to Stanford, but instead he took them to an isolated area in the woods in Alameda where he stabbed them and strangled them to death. Anita was locked in the trunk while he first killed Marianne. He took the bodies home, getting pulled over by the police on the way for a broken taillight. The officer didn't detect anything else was amiss, and Kemper was sent on his way. Back at his apartment, he did terrible things to the bodies and photographed the corpses. He then dismembered the bodies and discarded them in the mountains. Iko Ku and Cindy Shaw were killed and violated in a very similar way. Kemper buried Cindy's head in his mother's garden facing her bedroom because his mother always wanted people to look up to her. He would often assault and do very unfortunate things to these severed heads of the victims repeatedly before disposing of them. Rosalind Thorpe and Alice Louis were abducted, murdered, and violated after struggling to get home on public transport. They accepted Kemper's offer of a ride because he had a UCSC sticker on his car. The advice the university issued to students claimed drivers with stickers would get them to their destination safely. Kemper was able to obtain a sticker because his mother worked at the university. Thorpe was picked up first, so Louis was probably reassured by both the sticker and another woman being in the car. But Kemper was able to overpower both victims with his strength and size. On April 20th, 1973, Kemper bludgeoned his mother with a claw hammer while she slept and slit her throat with a penknife. He dismembered the body, violated the severed head before using it as a dartboard. He put his mother's corpse in a closet and went out to a bar. After returning home, he invited his mother's 59-year-old friend Sally Hallett over to watch a movie, but strangled her to death when she arrived. He fled to Colorado thinking he would be a prime suspect in his mother's murder. When there was no mention of it on the radio, he realized the bodies might not have been found yet. He stopped at a payphone and confessed. He later said he called the police because the original purpose was gone, and he was, at that point, too tired to keep going on. He was tried in October 1973. He pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, but psychiatrists deemed him legally sane because he showed signs of malice intent, and that he was aware that his crimes were wrong. On November 8th, he was sentenced to 7 to life for each of the 8 murders, to be served subsequently. He's been repeatedly denied parole over the years, and remains at the California Medical Facility in Vacaville, where he narrated hundreds of audiobooks as part of the prisoner program. He is currently 74 and eligible to reapply for parole next year. At one point, Kemper and Mullen were actually incarcerated at the same prison. Kemper said he hated Mullen, calling Mullen a cold-blooded killer who murdered people for no good reason. He didn't believe Mullen heard voices telling him to kill his victims. Kemper also claims he trained Mullen to stop bothering people when they were watching TV by throwing water on him when he was being annoying and giving him peanuts when he was quiet. It's likely Kemper was bullying Mullen to some extent considering the size difference between the two men. Kemper also has a very high IQ, so he would be capable of outsmarting most of his fellow inmates.
And that there is the story of how two serial killers simultaneously were killing people, leaving their bodies all over the cities, all in the woods, and even killing people in state parks. Now, I do have plans to cover an actual state park killer very, very soon, but I wanted to cover this story because I felt like it would be fun. It's definitely a classic, and I know a lot of people have been requesting more wilderness crime type stuff. Now, I do have more coming soon. They will be more in-depth, but it does take time, and I do appreciate all of your patience. Thank you so much for supporting The Swamp, and I'll see you next time with another creepy episode.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.